capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. I'm John Harrison. When we watch American blockbuster films, did you ever wonder why the West superheroes all sort seem to be American? Even when we journey to other planets and encounter other species, the people and technology seem to be predominantly from the United States. Why? You've guessed it. Because Americans have the most money to spend in their films, they're the biggest film industry, so why shouldn't they promote their own technology and make money from it all? But it goes a lot deeper than that. According to evidence compiled in a book called National Security Cinema, the uncompromising patriotism of Hollywood screenwriters, producers, and financiers is connected to direct involvement in American movie and TV scriptwriting and even production facilities by Washington. You don't believe me? Listen to this program. I'm lucky to be joined by the book's two authors, Dr. Matthew Alford, who is a teaching fellow at the University of Bath in England, and Tom Secker, who's a private researcher and runs spyculture.com, the world's premier online archive about government involvement in the entertainment industry. Welcome to the program, both of you gentlemen. You say in your book that between 1911 and 2017, over 800 films received support in one way or the other from the US's Department of Defense. Now, that's quite a statement, and it's quite shocking probably for some listeners. Could one of you please fill us in very briefly? How did Washington get involved in the American entertainment industry, and how has it continued up to the present day? Who'd like
I'll jump in on that one.
Okay, Matthew.
I guess it started in the 1910s, or at least that's as far back as we've been able to trace some kind of influence from the government and government agencies on Hollywood. So going back almost as long as Hollywood itself has existed, it really got going with the military in the 20s and 30s, but then accelerated rapidly during World War II and into the post-war period. The FBI got involved in the 1930s. They, at least up until the death of J. Edgar Hoover, had quite a prominent influence, I think, on Hollywood. The CIA had a covert influence, at least from their inception, up until the 1990s when they founded their entertainment liaison office. And now we have other agencies, Homeland Security, the ATF. They're all kind of jumping in on the bandwagon now. It's now quite a large-scale, formalized official operation.
Well, okay, now take us through it again a little bit, please. How did the Department of Defense get involved? What was the motivation and what were the carrots they were offered to?
The motivation for the Department of Defense getting involved is primarily and most overtly to recruit more people. To recruit soldiers and then other forms of personnel, because the movies obviously appeal directly to young people in particular. And they make no particular secret of that, although they sometimes kind of shy away from saying it. They'll sometimes say that, you know, recruitment efforts are just incidental to what, you know, they're sort of more benign, just sort of, oh, we just like to help out on the movies sort of thing. But they're not particularly shy about saying that they're recruiting. What Tom and I find more sinister is the byproduct of that, which is that they tend to rewrite history through the movies and rewrite the and give a very benign spin on the nature of their own institutions, a benign spin on the White House, same with the Central Intelligence Agency, same with the Department of Defense, and of course the FBI for a historical period of time, much less so now.
Yeah, so that sort of recruiting push, I suppose, was very prevalent during the war. And then we're into McCarthyism, and we all know all about McCarthyism and how the movie industry was controlled, and then people were blacklisted and so on if they didn't follow the line. But what I don't really understand, and I hope you can maybe tell me, what is the line now? I mean, what's Washington trying to get across now? I mean, because we're not at war, are we? Or are we with somebody or some countries or whatever? And I don't quite understand what the hidden message is, or does it change over the years?
Well, I'd say in the current period, it's not so much about the individual wars themselves. Indeed, what we found is that certainly when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, there are very, very few films being made about those wars, and virtually none of them have benefited from military support. So it's not really, I think, even about that anymore. It's more about, I guess, promoting the DoD itself and the security state itself, and just the broad underlying paradigm of US and NATO foreign policy. There is a world out there that's, you know, full of threats, and that we need these institutions in order to combat them.
Yep. Now, one of the methods that you document very well, actually, very carefully, sort of carrots, is the ability for film production companies to use facilities like the CIA facilities at Langford, or a Navy destroyer, or something in the Transformers film, all those Navy and Air Force bases and trucks, equipment, soldiers and so on. And these are dramatic effects to films. But what about everything else that's made in Hollywood? A lot of films are made that don't have any military kind of effects added on. Are they also somehow influenced by Washington?
I will field that just because we're backing and forth between myself and Tom.
Yeah.
All films come out of Hollywood is a power center in its own right, so it is reflecting a kind of set of dominant ideologies, whether that's capitalism or the idea that the American state is benign and so on. There isn't a secret entity which is controlling Hollywood, as far as we are aware, which is dictating exactly what happens in each of these films. They're just, you know, Hollywood is made up primarily of eight major studios with major parent companies that own them. Now, those parent companies might not be very nice. You know, they often have links to all sorts of unpleasant industries like the arms industry and things like that. But there's no kind of coordinated organization that rules over them or runs through them to affect every single movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's so much potential in Hollywood to create cultural products that are actually that are dissenting from the Washington line. But what we are pointing out is that whereas most people, for everyone, and the entire consensus was that the Department of Defense, if you'd asked someone, say, 15 years ago, you know, how much of influence does the Department of Defense have, even the leading experts in this field would have said that the DoD had only affected maybe a couple of hundred films or so over the previous century. Now we're talking, if you include the CIA and those other organizations, we're talking about several thousand entertainment products. So although this effect by the government is not total, it is at least, say, 5 or maybe even 10 times larger than anyone previously knew prior to Tom and I doing this research.
Yep. Okay, thank you very much. Now, could I ask you, please, Tom, it's your turn. Could you please sort of give us an example of a film that we've all seen or we all know about, and the way that it has been influenced? Let's not even use the word changed, but influenced by the powers to be in America.
Well, one of the best examples that we found, or one of the most detailed examples, was the 2003 movie Hulk, about the Incredible Hulk. And that film was thoroughly rewritten. I mean, even the Pentagon's own script notes apologize for how radical the changes were that they were making to the script in exchange for access to filming locations and vehicles and so on. So, for example, they changed the laboratory where the Hulk is accidentally created. That was originally a military laboratory. They changed it to a civilian facility. The guy running it was changed from a military character to an ex-military character. They removed a dialogue from a scene about that seemed to refer to military experiments on humans, on soldiers, on real people. And they changed the name of the operation to track down the Hulk from Ranch Hand, because that was a reference to a real-life Vietnam War-era chemical warfare operation on a massive scale. So no, they didn't want that reference, so it got changed from Ranch Hand to Angry Man. So you're talking about the sort of the underlying implied politics of an essentially apolitical film being carefully and, you know, subtly changed so that it distanced the military from any of the negative elements or potentially negative elements of the film, and so that their sole role that was left for them was just, again, as a benign entity who tracked down the Hulk and kind of stopped him from smashing everything up.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. Can I ask you about another film, the film Avatar, which many of us sort of campaigners for the rights of indigenous people actually thought it was a pretty good film, you know, and we thought it was sort of stood up for our rights, for their rights rather. I was quite surprised to read in your book that James Cameron really never ever thought of making that film to sort of seem to be an anti-American message or anything like that. Could you explain how that works, how that sort of Washington influence works in a film like Avatar?
Well, Avatar is one that we saw on the list provided by the Department of Defense, which said that it had had this this support, but we don't have, it's one of many cases where we don't have the specific script changes that have been made. Mm-hmm. But the part of this story is actually not just about the censorship of movies, but also about the reluctance, seemingly quite seriously contrived reluctance by the Department of Defense to prevent this kind of information getting out. That's why it's taken, I mean, I've been in this research field for about 15 years, and it's taken a long time to kind of piece together this kind of picture, which is why I had to bring in Tom Secker as this expert archivist who had been doing such good work on that. It takes a long time to acquire this kind of information. But yeah. Avatar is the pieces that we can put together on that suggest that there are quite obvious changes that were made to it by the military. One of them is that there is bits of dialogue in the script that quite pointedly and awkwardly makes the case that the military itself is not doing anything wrong, that these are private military contractors who are abusing these indigenous species. Whereas the real military is back on Earth fighting for freedom. They put that line in quite an obvious sort of ham-fisted change. More generally, I mean, it's great to hear that you're involved in fighting for the rights of indigenous people, but I know one organization called Survival International, which was asked James Cameron to make a statement on behalf of some indigenous people that they were fighting for. In fact, they took out a 20,000 dollar advert in a major industry newspaper to say, James Cameron, please make a statement. These are the real. This is the real Avatar that's happening here. Yeah. This is a place in India that was being mined and bulldozed and destroyed, and there was no response whatsoever, much to the charity's chagrin.
It's amazing, isn't it? You mentioned that there's a lot of different agencies involved, and that they're all separate, and there's no one sort of plot or anything. I buy that. I can well believe that. But can you tell us a little bit, please, about the FBI and the CIA involvement? How do they differentiate one from the other?
Well, most fundamentally, the FBI, we don't think, has a particularly strong role in Hollywood anymore. In so many ways, they've been usurped by the CIA. The CIA now definitively are the premier intelligence agency in the US. But during Hoover's period in charge, they were spying on people. They were, removing themselves from film scripts. They were doing all of these things that the Pentagon are now doing. In fact, in some ways, on a more insidious scale and in a much more insidious way, because, like I say, they were getting into people's private lives. They were, making people, even the biggest names in Hollywood, Marilyn Monroe, people like that, were under surveillance by them. And you can imagine at least the implied sense of don't do anything to upset the state, don't do anything to upset or go against significant policies and that kind of thing. So we don't know exactly whether the CIA are now doing a similar sort of thing, but certainly now they've taken over from the FBI as the premier intelligence agency in Hollywood.
I'm realizing that I'm talking to two people who are on the front line here. You're actually gathering information. You're trying to put together a picture out of little bits of information that you're hearing from many, many different sources. And so that's why you can't give me a definitive answer to some of these questions. But let's take a short break here.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Programme. Today I'm talking to Dr. Matthew Alford, who is a teaching fellow in propaganda and theory at the University of Bath in England, and Tom Secker, who is a private researcher and runs spyculture.com, about the link between Washington and Hollywood. Now, let's move on, please, to television. I somehow can't believe that the American government's involved in television, but of course I can. Is it true that series like 24, Homeland, and NCIS are influenced by the FBI and the White House through funding?
There isn't a great deal of funding that goes on here.
Right.
Money that is, I mean, there have been cases where money has been provided by clandestine agencies. The cartoon Animal Farm from 1954 was funded partly by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that was known about for a very long time, but that's an unusual case. We do occasionally hear rumours that that there is money involved with some of these organisations, but Tom and I have not been able to substantiate any of that, and we have, and no other academic has even gone near that.
How does it work? I mean, how do these the producers, the directors of these series, how are they influenced if there's no money involved? How does it work?
With the Department of Defense in particular, they are providing aircraft carriers and helicopters and advice and all this kind of thing. I mean, the a good case of that is Black Hawk Down, where Ridley Scott, the director, said, look, I could have made this film without the military, but I'd have had to have called it Huey Down, because, you know, named after this crappy little helicopter that can't be, you know, that would not look right at all on the battlefield. So, you know, sometimes they're really fundamental. Same with Transformers, probably the same with Iron Man. You know, these films, certainly Transformers could not have been made without military support. Series like 24, Alias, JAG, you know, these are all heavily involved by the national security state. Some of them, we just, you know, all we knew at the time was that there were rumors that the government was involved, or it seemed that they were involved. Similarly with Homeland, you know, CIA were involved in that, as well as, I think, Homeland Security. All the information on this comes out in dribs and drabs, but the most dribs and drabs have come out over the last 2 or 3 years, because there's been, partly because of our research, partly because of a couple of other decent books, and partly because of other, a few little, there's been some other lists that have been made. For example, the CIA put up a list of some of its films that it had been involved with that it had not previously ever put up. So, you know, a lot of this information comes several years after the fact, and it's just not known at the time.
Yep. I'm fascinated by the sort of ideological side of this whole thing. I mean, it seems as though the entertainment industry in the States is trapped to a sort of an ideological straitjacket to some kind, to perhaps a much greater extent than many realise. But at the same time, we have many other films by directors like, as you say in the book, Paul Verhoeven, Oliver Stone, Michael Moore. They get made and distributed. How does that work? I mean, I guess my question is, how are they able to get away with it?
Well, I guess most fundamentally, they are directors who don't bow to the wishes of the government agencies.
Yeah.
I mean, Oliver Stone has approached the DOD over a couple of films, but to my knowledge, he's never actually worked with them because they always wanted something he wasn't willing to give up.
Right.
So it's them having the guts to actually say no a lot of the time. But even outside of government-sponsored entertainment, Paul Verhoeven, for example, managed to make Starship Troopers largely because the studio system, as we understand it, was failing. The Sony board of directors at that time was in total chaos. There were people getting fired all the time, and everyone was just getting replaced. And it just seems that for about 6 or 8 months, they could more or less make the film that they wanted to, and no one was really looking at the dailies and saying, no, you're going wrong here, you need to change this, or you need to not do that.
Yeah.
So as a result, they actually had an enormous amount of creative freedom to make a $100 million art movie in some ways.
Yeah.
So every once in a while, the studio system fails. And also, on the smaller scale, when you're talking about outside of the majors, there are quite a lot of smaller studios who are willing to take risks, who are willing to spend a few million dollars making an unusual, provocative, challenging movie like Nightcrawler or Kill the Messenger or something like that, which, you know, they do actually end up making really, really good, not only pieces of entertainment, but also pieces of political theatre, if you like. So
yeah,
it's much more possible on the smaller scale, I suppose, yeah, is what we can conclude from that.
Yeah, so we're not looking at sort of nationwide cover-all plots, you know, run by the government that controls every single television show and film that comes out. You're talking about selective procedure. Now, okay, dangerous question. Out of 100%, you know, of all American video entertainment industry products, how many would you say are influenced by Washington? What percentage? 10%? 20%?
I think that's... I'd be interested to hear what Tom thinks about that. One way I can answer it is to say that if you see a film that has got military things in it, like helicopters and planes,
okay,
and that kind of weaponry, you've probably got a sort of between a 30 and 50% chance that it is that it's been contracted into the Department of Defense or work closely with one of the other major national security organizations, which will have had an impact on the script. So it's not complete, it's not total, but it's a very sizable chunk. Then, of course, there's a load of other films that have just got nothing to do with the military, you know. So, you know, they're obviously not going to have that kind of support. But, you know, it sometimes does happen. Sometimes there's even support for, you know, random things like Superman or what, you know, those kind of, you know, or odd things like Meet the Parents, you know, comedies like that.
Right.
So you can't always rule it out.
Okay. Why do people go along with it? I mean, why do the directors and the producers and the financiers just seem to go along with this system then? I mean, is this sort of inbuilt patriotism thing so strong in the States? I mean, imagine this happening in Britain. Could it happen in Britain? Does it happen in Britain?
Up to a point, I think it does happen in Britain, but we're still in the process of trying to document exactly how that process works and what,
yeah,
you know, whether they have the same kind of influence that the DOD and CIA and so on does. But in terms of the producers and them, they're going along with this because it's far cheaper to make a film that way.
Ah,
if you can be
okay,
provided access to a dozen unusual locations and $1 billion worth of aircraft as props in the background, where else can you get that? And certainly where else can you get that for, you know, a few $100,000? So from the men's point of view, it's cheaper. A lot of these directors are pretty patriotic and pro-militaristic anyway, and would be even if they'd never worked with the military, partly because they've grown up in a militarized pop culture. So it's kind of just echoing what was already there, particularly by this point when you've got, like, you know, third or fourth generation directors who've grown up watching dozens and dozens of films that were manipulated and sponsored by the DOD.
Right.
So there are a number of different factors as to why they just go along with it.
And it's just a subtle few changes in the script that can change the whole film, can't it? A few words here and there, a change in a name or two, perhaps a location switch. You can alter the meaning, the deep meaning of a film completely, can't you, really?
Yeah, I certainly think so. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take a great deal to... I mean, I think that's one of the things as well, is that it's not always that these major organisations are there to try and inject propaganda, although that is very much more the case than anyone realised. But it's also that they've got to be there to make sure that things don't go ahead, you know, that they don't have the, you know, Operation Ranch Hand because it's from, you know, it's a chemical weapons program in the Vietnam War. You don't want to have that mentioned. It's about, a lot of it's about removing things, just being on site to ensure that nothing too real comes out on screen.
Nothing too real comes out on screen. Okay, well, that's, if you don't mind, I'll quote that in the write-up for this radio program. Now, entertainment products rip their stories from news headlines, which in turn broadly reflect the views of political power systems. The thing that staggers me really is that we, the audience, as well, support this. You know, we go along and we pay our £6 or our $10, our $15 or $25. We want a really good seat and a really good sound system. You know, otherwise it's not a blockbuster, it's not a major seller. We also buy into it. We also kind of are part of the system. I guess everybody factors that in as well, don't they?
I suppose so, because there seems to be very little opposition to this, both,
yeah,
from within the industry and from audiences. I mean, to be honest, when we tell people about this, most people are quite shocked that this is even going on, let,
yeah,
alone the extent. This is one of the fundamental issues here, is that audiences are going into this blind. They don't know that the films that they're watching have been rewritten by some government PR person. So that puts them at a massive disadvantage in terms of, you know, what they then absorb and take seriously in their own lives and as applied to the real world.
Yeah. Matthew, now, another aspect of this is the distribution system. Is there, and I don't mean to be naughty and suggest dangerous thoughts or anything like that into your minds, but could there be a kind of agreement with the people who distribute the films around the cinema networks, around not only in the States but around the world, that if a film has been made with the cooperation of a certain agency, that film will be distributed more widely and more quickly?
Well, again, I think that's an interesting area for someone to take up. We've not come across anything systematic on that.
Okay.
I mean, it's certainly the case you've got several hundred military bases across the world which can show films, for example. And there was the case of the Kevin Costner film, 13 Days, which is a very accurate and critically well-received film about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which the Department of Defense wanted to work on but hated because it showed what the real world was like, which was that the military was about to cause a nuclear war between Russia and the United States.
Oh, is that all? Okay.
Right. Yeah. So they decided ultimately that they could not cooperate. And I believe, at least according to one of our sources, that which is very hard to back up with documentation because the documentation is kept private. But one of our sources is quite clear that the military bases would not screen that film, whereas obviously previously it would have been a shoo-in for a screening. And that, you know, obviously does dent profits. You know, when you've got thin margins, if you've lost several hundred bases all around the world, you know, that's a dent in your profits. So they don't really want to do that. Like Tom says, you know, this works in everybody's interest, really, except, of course, the audiences, the public.
Yeah, the public who may be sort of fighting the sort of acceptance of normality, maybe asking questions, but they go and see a film and they go, oh, well, forget about that questioning. They're back where they were, but, you know, everything's fine, isn't it? You know, final question, product placement. Is there any influence here, any sort of governmental influence? I suppose products can be helicopters, ships, battles, you know, using weapons, that's all products. They're all products in a way, aren't they? Promotion of brands. But what about, you know, other things like Apple computers and stuff like that? How does that work?
Well, I mean, it doesn't really involve government agencies at all. That's a process, like Matt said before. I mean, these big studios, they are ultimately large corporations who are usually parts of even larger corporations. So that just comes as part and parcel of the process of making a film, I think, these days. But it can have a huge influence, at least economically, because there are now films that are almost covering their production budgets by having so much product placement in their films that, you know, they just have to pay for marketing and then everything beyond that is profit.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't rule out the kind of parallel style of product placement. The nation state, for example, is product placement. You now have a lot of countries paying tens of millions of dollars in tax rebates and so on, so that Hollywood will come and film in their country and promote their country. So even that is now a product of a sort that is being promoted through the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, you might remember that there was that 2009 film, Australia, with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman, which was called Australia, which was, I think it was Rupert Murdoch's company, Fox. But, you know, they almost paid, I think, for the production costs just because it was all subsidized by the Australian government. So, you know, it's kind of, and it made Australia look really, really lovely. You know, I don't particularly even object to things like that. Do you know what I mean?
It's no, right.
Neither Tom or I think, are arguing for a kind of radical takedown of the Hollywood system. All we're suggesting is that there needs to be better accountability. And there really is poor accountability at the moment, as even in the case of the CIA, tried to investigate its own affairs on this matter, and they just said they couldn't follow what was happening. So, I mean, there really does need to be, at the beginning of each movie, this film is made with the cooperation of X, Y, and Z, and then open up the files. I mean, that's all we're asking.
Yeah, well, I think you're asking a bit too much there. Sorry.
Well, I do happen to agree with you there, John. But,
yeah, I don't really think it's going to happen, you know, at least not tomorrow or the next day or even the next few years, I am afraid. But hey, what a fantastically interesting conversation we've had. I think that your reference to reality is something that has to be has to be taken very serious, and that is something that can be curated. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Matthew Alford, a teaching fellow at the University of Bath in England, and Tom Secker, who's a private researcher and who runs spyculture.com, the world's premier online archive about government involvement in the entertainment industry. Don't forget that you can buy their book called National Security Cinema. I believe it's available on Amazon. Thank you very much indeed, listeners, for being with us today. I hope you found this program interesting. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.